And my name is Michael.
And we are Dungeons & Dragons DMs who love to homebrew items, spells, rules, creatures, and features for Dungeons & Dragons. This is a show where we challenge each other, ourselves, and are challenged by our community to come up with new homebrew every week. We get prompts from the community, we roll on a big random table, and that decides what we're going to make this week. And this week, we rolled and got ourselves our very first monster. Michael, do you want to remind the people what exactly it was that we rolled for last week?
I would love to. We rolled for a Rancor-inspired homebrew monster that carries around a metal door. So this is the Rancor from the Star Wars canon, carrying around a metal door. I thought this was an interesting prompt, because it very easily could have just been a Rancor, right? Why specifically carrying around the door? That was so intriguing.
Well, I think it's because, and I did go back and watch the scene, because I needed it for inspiration. I think it might have something to do with the fact that the ultimate demise of the Rancor, which is held in the pit below Jabba's palace, is that Luke avoids it for a while and then closes the big metal door on its neck. And it falls down, you know, and then its handler like cries because it's very, very sad. It's actually kind of a weirdly tragic scene in that moment. They make a point of like cutting away to the Rancor's handler and how sad he is that the Rancor has died.
Yeah. It's just an animal in captivity.
Yeah. I
it
mean,
wasn't the Rancor's fault that Luke was thrown down in that pit.
Tell you what, I don't know if you did the same, but I went into some Star Wars lore, or I guess I should say, I went into a bit of a rabbit hole down Star Wars lore and the larger, extended universe origins and things of Rancor, that creature plus others like it.
I did the opposite. I wanted to stay as far away from the lore as possible.
That's totally fine. It sounds like we ended up in very different directions then, which is always good.
Yeah. From the title of what you submitted, I haven't looked at it yet, but it seems to be completely opposite of what I did. So I'm excited to get into it.
I'm also very excited, mostly because I've done the same thing that I have done for many weeks now, which is to say that I created a base idea and then a version of that thing and then thought to myself, well, this could be a lot more than just one thing, couldn't it? So we'll get into that, but that is absolutely my pattern.
I actually tapered myself this week.
Very nice.
I only have two stat blocks in my submission, and they kind of go together. Oh. So really just one general monster with two stat blocks.
I don't even have two stat blocks. I just have the one. I reined myself in.
Oh, wow.
I thought about how this could be more, and I will explain how it could be more, but I decided only to actually build out the first one. And then if that spurs ideas for me or you beyond that, I think I'm just going to like let that come out later.
I would love it if it does.
Yeah.
We love a little bit of extra inspiration.
Absolutely. It's always good when you land on an idea that's fun enough that you can see it growing into something else. I have a question about your sort of process during this creation, because we haven't made a monster yet, so I feel like it's a good idea to sort of take step back and talk about creating monsters, because obviously, we've made a couple of subclasses, we've made a good number of items, a couple of feats, and other features like that. And I think the mechanics are very different for a monster, right? And
so certainly,
I'm really interested to know your process, how much you take into account the math of it. Do you do a full calculation to figure out like as close to as possible the CR that you're looking for?
I think that the worst metric in the entire game is CR. I think it sucks. I think it absolutely is the worst representation of a monster's ability, of a monster's lethality. So I'm gonna be
Preach.
Totally honest. I think I changed one of the CRs in one of my stat blocks. I don't think I even bothered to change the CR. Like I entered the code in Homebrewery to put a stat block in for the monster. Mm-hmm. I think it just has the CR in there that came with the stat block because I thought about it so little that I forgot that it was even there. Sure. I hate CR so much.
Talk more about that.
Not as much as the Battle Rager Barbarian, but pretty much.
What is it about CR that makes it so ineffectual or infuriating to you?
Here's what it is, right? The CR is directly tied to the number of players, the action economy that is on the board as a whole from both sides, trying to balance it out as much as you can. And there are just some monsters that defy that concept so much that I don't value or trust challenge rating in any way. There is a very low level monster called an intellect devourer that can literally take over another creature's body, and it's like a CR1 or a CR2. I can't remember exactly, but it's an incredibly low, and it can just dominate like a level 17, level 18 PC and eliminate all of its intelligence. Your intelligence drops to zero and you're unable to do anything. So how do you quantify that and set that next to like a CR10 giant that's just a hit point pool but can only use a club as an action? So all of that to say, my digression ends right here, I start with just the mechanics. I think about what the implications of the flavor of the monster have on what it can do, and I try and start mechanically and move out from there. In this specific case, this was a weird one because of the concept that I went with. It's two separate monsters that are kind of working in tandem. So that was a little, the lines were blurred there. So this mechanically is actually different than I normally would do. So it's kind of like half and half. Each stat block kind of informs the other, which you'll see in a bit.
Yeah.
Typically, I will take the idea, work the mechanics, and then build out from there, like immunities and skills and things like that. That will come later.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think CR is a deeply flawed metric. It's not a particularly useful tool when it comes to defining and balancing encounters, which I think is what that number is really intended to be there for, but it's not really good at its job because of those like edge cases, right? I think of the shadow is another low level, like
the
low
shadow.
CR monster that the strength drain ability really tips things hard. And, you know, the math gets really fiddly the second one PC goes down. The math changes aggressively. And that makes it really
God
hard
forbid,
to manage
too. Like,
metric
if you, if you drain
I think
enough
you're
strength
right. There
for
are
multiple
enough edge
party
cases
members,
that
you may as well just
really
write the TPK right then.
What I prefer, I do some calculation. So it's a CR calculator.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives you the defensive CR and the offensive CR as it defines it. Like, I'm thinking of the Intellect Devourer. It doesn't have a very high defensive CR, right? It's got very few hit points, and it's got a low AC. So you can hit it easily, and you can probably down it in one or two strikes most of the time. Right, so that swings it really hard. It averages those out though to get the CR. So the offensive CR, you have to imagine, is much higher because it has the potential to do a like take somebody out of the fight basically immediately. Like it can be really devastating. So that offensive capability is really high. And that gets balanced out by a really low defensive capability. And it gets averaged out to something that doesn't actually reflect clearly how the thing is going to interact in the fight. And I think those other numbers, that idea of like I'm going to look at the defensive CR and I'm going to look at the offensive CR. And that's just going to inform my tactics using that monster.
Right.
More than that number ever is, right? More than the basic CR number is going to tell me this is a balanced encounter.
Mm-hmm.
It will tell me this is the kind of monster that can do a ton of damage, but is really weak. So if I send one into the middle of a bunch of people, it has the potential to do something pretty crazy, but also, you know, what are its strategies? What can I assess about its strategies based on the fact that it is really weak in terms of defense, but really has the ability to, if it gets someone alone away from a group, the way it's designed really implies that it's like, this thing will stick to the shadows. It will try to get one person alone so that it can like do what it needs to do without threat of being hurt by that thing's allies.
Right.
So I just let that inform tactics more than I actually use it to like define balance.
Yeah. I think maybe my hatred of CR stems from when I first started DMing and I let it control so much of my prep. Like I was really, and maybe this is a pitfall that maybe it's not just me. Maybe a lot of people fall into the same trap where they let CR dictate so much of their brain space. When really I was using CR as the metric to make my encounters and just getting destroyed, or I was, you know, danger close to full party kill many times on accident because I was just swaying too far to the extremities. So yeah, ever since then, I just, I don't even pay attention to it at all.
Well, I think every 5e DM has a story of a time when they built a very deadly encounter, like well over the party's daily budget for XP, and the party just smoked it.
Steam
and then roll. They've also got a story about how they made like a medium encounter and it just about destroyed everything.
I made an encounter full of banshees in my first campaign. For my first mistake was having players start at level 10. I was like, yeah, I can handle this. No, absolutely, I could not. So we were in this kind of like underdark space. So I said, I'm going to put a bunch of undead. I'm going to put a bunch of ghosts down there. That's going to be really cool and thematically correct. It was like an encounter with like 10 banshees. Did not read the stat block beforehand. And like two whale attacks, the entire party was down and I needed to stop. So I just made them run away. I made the banshees just say, yeah, I'm out. These were our goals, to just get you down on the ground, and now we're going away because I was terrified of killing my party. And one more attack would have done it my first time around the block, and that still haunts me. And now I read everything in explicit detail.
There are also, yeah, so many things like that are also huge metrics that aren't factored into the CR number.
Yeah.
So for those of you at home who maybe are starting to homebrew, starting to get into creating monsters and that sort of thing, you'll find a lot of these tools online that allow you to calculate the DPR of that monster, that allow you to calculate all of its various like defensive, offensive capabilities, including a bunch of features that are frequently present. I forget where it is in the DMG, but there's a big, long section that kind of goes over creating your own monsters and figuring out what that CR number is. You will find, though, that there are a lot of things that are not taken into account into that number. There are a couple things that adjust it by, you know, multiply it by 1.5 here and there, that sort of thing. But a lot of things, like the ability to just incapacitate a few people for a round.
Paralyze, petrify, like even knock.
There's a ton of like little abilities that only one monster has here and there. So they don't really include it into the features. Also, spells and the different features of spells are usually not counted into there either. So if you've got a monster that has innate spell casting, what are those spells that they can cast? And how do
they're
those
typically
stack up?
Much more powerful than their CR implies. Yeah.
Yeah, like because they're doing things that maybe aren't really factored into that number, and it's hard to figure out how to factor them into that number. So you're ending up with just an imperfect metric. So go ahead and use those tools if you're making new monsters or whatever it is, or if you're designing encounters. Those numbers can be a good guideline, but I do think you really need to read the monster stat block, see what they do, let it inform your tactics, and let that understanding of their tactics, your party dynamic, all of that stuff inform what actually is going to be a good and interesting and complex fight for this group. Does this monster, which says that two of them are a deadly encounter, could I actually add four of them because I know the way that I want these things to function and how the party functions, and those things are going to clash in a way that actually they would wipe out two of these easily. So I need yep. two more of them to be able to like flank on the other side or whatever it is, you know, like read the stat blocks. I would not rely on those numbers whole.
Not at all.
Ever.
Nope. Yeah. Nope. Don't go in blind. That is for sure a big piece of advice. I would love to see what you've made for your monster this week.
I will tell you. Yeah, I have a similar approach to you. Mechanics are usually the first thing that I come up with. I come up with the concept and what I want that concept to represent. I thought of a bunch of things going into here in regards to how that door could be used. Could be a weapon, could be a shield, mm-hmm. could be something entirely different. So did I want to create a monster that had like a parry feature? Did I want to have something like a shield bash? I don't know. Messed around with a bunch of ideas and thoughts and decided I'm going to go down a little rabbit hole of Star Wars lore. And with that, it also took me down a little bit of a rabbit hole, or not even a rabbit hole, just a little trip down memory lane. Because the first okay. TTRPG that I ever played was the Star Wars D6 system. It's still out there. You can still get it. You can still play it. I remember it being quite a lot of fun. This was in middle school, so it's a very different version of what it is today, I'm sure. But I was looking at some content from those games, and I was looking into some of the Star Wars deep lore, and I decided, you know what? I'm going to take some inspiration from both of these things and create an entirely new monster class, monster group. So go ahead and open up your document here. This is the basic starting point of an entire, essentially, race of creatures.
Okay.
An entire species. Known as the Kefando. I did translate things from Huttese to okay. get this name.
Okay.
So in actual Star Wars lore, the word Kefando translates roughly to hungry or the hungry one. And I will just read you my preamble here. Upon their first encounter with these massive bipedal reptilians, humans found them frightful and grotesque. The average Kefando stands between 12 and 18 feet tall, has elongated arms with curved claws for grasping prey, and a carnivorous mouth with rows of monstrous teeth. Hunters by nature and viciously effective, some humans quickly saw the opportunity to turn such a strength to their own causes. Since then, Kefando have been marched into battle as siege monsters, pitted against gladiators in fighting pits, and secured as guard dogs for both wealthy lords and back-alley gangsters alike. A distinct feature of their strategy as combatants is their distinctive creativity when using their environment to their advantage. Rarely are they the quickest of creatures, nor do they have the thickest hides, and their long, sinewy limbs give them more reach but less raw physical power. Therefore, the Kefando have found unique ways to use objects as shields, obstructions, projectiles, and other unpredictable methods to subdue their enemies.
This is great.
So, what I've created here is one version of this creature, the Kefando shield beast. However, the concept here is that this is the sort of creature, the base creature, that could be customized easily to all kinds of different fighting styles. One that uses some sort of large, heavy chain that has extended reach, can grapple, this sort of thing, you know? The idea comes from the actual lore of Rancor creatures. The one in Jabba's palace has a name that translates in Huttese to friend. So they are, you know, semi-intelligent creatures. They have, in the Star Wars lore, a society all their own. They are not the most intelligent. They do not have a space travel or anything like that. But they are fully sentient beings.
Sure.
And so I went into this, actually, the sadness of that moment with the handler.
Yeah.
And thought, there is some tragedy here. There is some tragedy of these things being misunderstood and utilized as pure beasts for violence alone. And how could I play with that and still hit the brief? So this brief does go into a creature that, like, does have the ability to do violence. But I wanted to weave in that lore to say that if I were to create more on this, or if you were, or if somebody else were to take this idea and create more versions of these creatures, that they don't all have to be explicitly violent. They can be creative and interesting in different ways, perhaps, based on this lore that they have been used as slave labor or gladiatorial combat or whatever else. All of that is preamble to say, here's my Kefando shield beast.
It sounds like we need to do an episode in the future where we both make a bunch of these.
Maybe. I'm honestly just happy to leave it at this one right now. And if I come up with some more, I'll put them up on the Patreon. If other people want to come up with ideas that fit into this lore and build out the lore even further, perhaps, great. Please send it to me.
Please
let
us know.
More than anything. So this is a large monstrosity. It is neutral in alignment. Armor class is 15. That is with this door being used partially as a shield. So without that shield, it becomes a 13. Okay. It's got 105 hit points. It has a speed of 30. I'll go through your ability scores real quick. You've got a strength of 18, dexterity of 10, constitution 14, intelligence 7, wisdom 14, and charisma 10. So pretty average creature all told. Not particularly overwhelming in any respect. It's good at athletics, obviously, and it also has proficiency in perception, which comes from, again, watching that scene. It is hunting down Luke with its sense of smell, which I even considered giving it that keen sense ability, but decided against it in the end. But that perception proficiency remains. It has some dark vision for 60 feet, and understands common, but doesn't have the ability to speak. I put it as a challenge rating 4, honestly. who knows? It has, in its actions, we'll go into its actions then. It has a multi-attack, so it makes 2 attacks with its claws, its door slam, or its door crush, and only one of those attacks can be a door crush. So it's got the ability to attack with the door that it has on its arm, but also can attack just on its own. Its claws are a simple melee weapon, and they do a D8 plus 4 slashing damage. Its door slam is where we get into the interesting stuff. So it has plus 6 to hit, does 1D10 plus 4 bludgeoning damage, and the target must make a DC 14 strength saving throw or be knocked prone. Then we get to the door crush, which is another melee weapon attack against one prone target. The target must be prone to be crushed by this door. To hit, it has a plus 6, and it does 2d8 plus 4 bludgeoning damage. So you can imagine the combination of trying to slam a creature down to the ground and then quickly slam that door onto them. It's a massive, like, 15-foot metal door that they are carrying, doing a good amount of damage there. Now, they also have another option that they can use this shield for, which removes the shield bonus that they have to their AC. The Kefando impales the spiked side of its door shield onto the ground in a straight line 15 feet long and 1 foot wide. Basically just slam it down right into the ground. Each creature in the area there must make a DC 14 dexterity saving throw, and on a fail save takes 2d10 plus 5 piercing damage and becomes pinned under the door. So you are prone and restrained until the door is moved. It is too large, to be moved by anything other than this like massive creature. On a successful save, the creature takes a little bit of the half damage, not restrained, not pinned under the door, anything like that. But while the door is thrust into the ground, the Kefauna no longer adds its shield bonus to its AC and cannot use its door slam or door crush attacks. So it can spend Makes its sense. Action on a subsequent turn to remove the door from the ground, basically prying it back up. But that sort of presents a secondary combo of trying to get maybe two or possibly even three creatures in this line, take this door and just sort of slam it down to pin them to the ground and do a good amount of damage. And then while they are pinned, it can kind of just go crazy. So that's the first idea. The backstory, the lore, the base creature could be any number of other things. Also, the design of this layout here is heavily inspired by the original Star Wars D6 system pages.
I love it. I was just gonna say it looks very familiar.
Yes, they are.
Really good.
It's a very simple, beautiful white page that I remember looking at for hours upon hours. So this was a really fun experience for me to just, you know, play around with an old world that I haven't messed around with too much in.
Yeah,
so that was fun.
Now this is great. A few things. I really enjoy how accessible this stat block is. Admittedly, the opposite direction of mine. Mine are both a bit convoluted, so I really enjoy that anybody could pick this up and operate this monster, but also have some cool things to do with it. I think a lot of times in the... I think a lot of times in published content, it does kind of fall under that needs to be perfect for publishing effect, where if something is simple and accessible, it is kind of boring. You know, you have your multi-attack with your bite and your claws, and that's it. That's all you can do, and you just have a giant hit point pool. And this has a little bit of everything, and that's very nice. And then the option of expanding out into additional series through the lore is awesome. This is great.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's really... It does seem that there is less and less, as more and more things get published, there's less and less middle ground of like creatures who are you know, not just like so simple that it's just multi-attack and hit point sync. There are so many of those. They already exist. Honestly, I could just reskin something like a giant ape or something to function as a Rancor if I really needed to. But the intention to create something new and special does sort of want to make it a little more complicated, interesting. But I do agree that sometimes you go too far in the opposite direction and try and... Again, we're talking about overloading. Like, I considered, like I said, giving it keen sense, giving it a couple other things. Reach, something similar to a bugbear's long-limbed feature. And even thought about giving it the parry feature because it could use this door. But it was like, that was so much stuff in a pretty simple monster, all told. And I did want to leave that room open for myself or somebody else to make other versions of it. And if I were to overcomplicate too many elements of the stat block, I think it would be harder and less fun to do that. So I decided to just like keep myself simple this time around. And I'm glad that I did.
It's great. I like this a lot.
Thanks. So mine was obviously really heavily reliant on reflavoring and reskinning and like pulling little bits of Star Wars lore into the D&D world. It sounds like yours was very much the opposite, so I'd love to know what we're talking about here.
Mine was absolutely the opposite. I went into this wanting to pull as little from Star Wars as possible. My first step was to watch the actual clip of the Rancor, you know, Luke falling into the pit, the Rancor advancing on him, and then ultimately being felled by the door. This is not my typical first step, but I did search on the internet to find other Rancor stat blocks to see what other people had done. And normally I don't do that if I'm trying to make that monster, but I did go into this thinking that the actual Rancor monster was the least interesting part. What was more interesting to me was the inclusion of the door in the prompt. That to me was so interesting that that was the stipulation. So the door was the most interesting part.
Sure. Yeah.
So how does the door, being stuck in this Rancor already, factor into this stat block? So I made two stat blocks. I made a monster centered around the specific Rancor, the friend Rancor that was killed in the movie, and the element of power within Hutt Palace. I call my monster the Spectre of Hutt Castle. And I'll read this little blurb that I wrote at the beginning here. Where there is energy, often there is life, and the power coursing through Hutt Castle is teeming with energy. Countless years of close proximity to cosmic magic and influence from both sides of the Force have granted the technology within the castle a relative level of sentience. This, mixed with the overabundance of death that occurs within the walls of the palace, has led to a fusion between electrical power and hundreds of potent ethereal souls. This is the Spectre of Hutt Castle. For centuries, the power grid of Hutt Castle has operated as a closed circuit, and with no way for electricity to escape, the static Spectre has spent its time observing its surroundings, developing its knack for technological possession, and anticipating what could be the quickest route to freedom. All of that time spent lying in wait paid off, however. In the moment, one of the control panels used to operate a powered door was destroyed by Luke Skywalker. The Spectre was released from the power system and into the open air. Although its elemental nature prohibits the Spectre from possessing living creatures, it can easily take control of any piece of technology, any loose object that can hold an electronic charge, or any destroyed piece of the Hutt Castle power system. So this is my conceit. The Spectre possesses the door, which then possesses the Rancor, which we'll get to in a second.
First of all, I love the technological bent to the lore, but also to this creature. I'm just like glancing at the stat block and all that stuff that's sort of around technology. Very cool. I actually do like a thing that like is kind of setting specific. It's not necessarily broadly applicable, but is able to be a lot more fine-tuned and very cool. So I like that. Very fun.
It's pretty much locked down to this place. I did kind of allude to the idea that it could go other places, but we'll get to that. So this is the Spectre stat block. I called this a small elemental undead. I think that's a little bit of both. It's chaotic neutral. Armor class of 12, 25 hit points with a 50-foot fly speed. Getting on to stats, we have 7 strength, 15 dex, 11 con, 19 intelligence, 18 wisdom, and 13 charisma. So heavy in the soft skills, as it should be. It's resistant to a whole slew of different damage types, immune to a few other ones, immune to pretty much every condition. It's got dark vision. Mm-hmm. It only speaks common. I set the CR at 4, but that could go up and down. What I'm really excited about is this next section, its abilities and the connection from those abilities to the Rancor monster itself. So it's incorporeal. It can move through other creatures. It's got legendary resistances. Primordial nature allows the Spectre to be unaffected by dismissal features that typically would affect undead. So like dispel evil and good affects elementals in a way, but the actual turning portion of that spell doesn't affect this specific Spectre because it's an elemental as well. And then any creature that comes into physical contact with the Spectre can take some lightning damage if it fails a con save. The actions. We have Circuit Touch, which is a melee spell attack. It's just a little bit of lightning damage within a 5-foot reach. It does have some spell casting. It can cast Lightning Lure as a cantrip. At will, it can cast Arcane Lock and Knock. I use these to kind of kind of a D&D vernacular workaround to say that it has control over the security system of the palace, so it can open and shut doors at will and lock people in, you know, block makes sense. Into different rooms. Three times a day, it can cast a chromatic orb with lightning damage only. Twice a day, call lightning, lightning bolt, and glyph of warding, also only lightning damage for the glyph of warding spell.
I love it.
This is the bread and butter, though. Its last action is called technological possession. It enters a piece of technology or a loose object that can hold an electronic charge. If the target is a construct, it has to make a wisdom save. If it fails, then it's possessed. This all goes on to say that if the possessed object has a stat block, the specter assumes those stats while keeping its spellcasting ability. If it doesn't, it has its stats boosted a little bit just to give it a little more beef while it's possessed. If the possessed object is connected to, lodged within, or otherwise inseparable from a deceased creature, like the Rancor, the possession is extended to the corpse of that creature. The possession lasts until the object or construct drops to zero hit points, or the specter ends it as a bonus action.
It's a fun little way to get around it.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm possessing...
I like it.
So essentially the idea here is that the specter possesses the door that is lodged inside of this Rancor, and that allows it to take control of the monster as a whole.
I like it. I think it's fun. I must say I also really like the keeping the damage types for those spells that it can cast to lightning damage. I even love it when special stat blocks even say, like, you can cast this spell, but instead of the normal damage type, it becomes lightning damage or whatever else, right?
Yeah.
Like, it can cast Fireball, but it's lightning damage. And it's like, oh, that's
it's a giant,
a fun thing that you're allowed to do if you want, which is cool. So that's very fun. I'm already excited about what's coming next, but I just want to say how much I want to use this in, like, a spooky, derelict space station sort of one-shot. It feels like
it is
right
a very
there.
Haunted
Beautiful.
Space
it
station.
Can, it can move around and it can lock doors. Oh, it's great.
Yeah. It's
take control of the computers and stuff. Oh, very
it's
good.
Very malleable. Yeah, it's very like Smart House, Disney Channel original movie. Once it turns on the family. We have some lair actions because it is specific to the castle.
Oh, yeah, cool.
On initiative count 20, I gave some lair actions. The specter either unlocks and opens or closes and locks up to 5 doors that it can see. So it can open a bunch of passageways or lock people down as a lair action. A cluster of wires, a service light bulb, or other electronic device is overpowered and bursts. Any creature within 10 feet of the device must make a dex save or take some lightning damage. And any room that's occupied by the specter is doused in magical darkness for 1d4 rounds. This count includes the current round. So you can shut the lights off as a later action. There are also a number of regional effects. If you enter combat against the specter while within Hutt Castle, the following effects are active. Any damage done by the specter ignores resistance to lightning damage. All flat surfaces within 20 feet of the specter are charged with electricity and considered difficult terrain. Any creature that touches a metal surface in a room also occupied by the specter with their bare skin that is not being carried or worn, because I'm not going to charge somebody's mace or whatever, immediately takes 1d6 lightning damage, and their speed is reduced to 0 until the start of their next turn. And the specter can see all invisible creatures and objects. So it is fully sentient. It is omniscient in this place. So it can become deadly very fast. It's one of those. It's an intellect devourer. It only has 25 hit points, but it can seriously mess a party up.
If
the plan does not go well.
Right.
When the specter of the castle was released, the door controlled by the destroyed power supply ceased to function. As electricity was lost, the door fell, lodging itself within the nape of an unsuspecting Rancor attempting to move through the entryway. As the impaled Rancor's life was ended almost immediately, the specter was quickly able to possess the fallen door and take control of its hulking corpse. So this is the stat block for the Rancor itself. It is a huge undead, has no alignment, armor class of 13 because it's big. It's making no defensive measures. It has 0 hit points and a speed of 45 feet. As for stats, it has a 25 strength and 8 dexterity and no scores for the other 4 stats. Mm-hmm. No constitution, no soft skills. It is completely brain dead, just being controlled by the Spectre. It's immune to everything except for magical, bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing. And as you can see here, the challenge is blank. okay, some abilities here. The Rancor is a conduit. Every time the Rancor takes lightning damage, the bonus to its attack and damage rolls increases by 1. All increases granted by this ability return to 0 if the door is dislodged from its neck. The idea here is to defeat this monster and break the possession. The party has to figure out how to remove the door, or the Rancor is going to keep going forever. So the Rancor can move and take actions without any hit points, but only as long as the metal door is lodged in its neck. The Rancor automatically succeeds on con saves, but automatically fails all intelligence, wisdom, and charisma saves. And the Rancor's movement speed can't be reduced in any way.
Great.
And then moving down to our actions, we also have a multi-attack. We have a bite and claw attack, as well as a grasp attack and a toss attack.
Cool.
The Spectre instructs the Rancor to make 3 attacks, 1 with its bite and 2 with its claws, or 1 bite and 1 toss. The bite attack and claw attack are pretty standard, piercing and slashing damage. Getting down to the grasp attack, when making a claw attack, the Spectre can instead decide to instruct the Rancor to attempt a grapple. The Rancor makes a strength check, an athletics check, contested by an athletics or acrobatics check from the target. If the target loses the contest, it's grappled and enclosed within the Rancor's fist, able to recontest the check at the end of each of its turns. And then we have our toss attack down at the bottom. This is a 50-foot range. For one target, the Spectre instructs the Rancor to throw a creature that's grappled within its claw. It does 3d10 bludgeoning damage, and upon impact, the thrown creature also takes identical damage. So even if it misses, you're doing some damage to the creature that was thrown. So the Rancor itself, the actions that it has are pretty standard, but the way it's controlled is through the Spectre. So they can kind of operate independently, but they are much more devastating, much more deadly, linked together.
And so just to confirm, the Rancor doesn't like ever really take any damage, and the Spectre doesn't
the does not take any damage.
The damage doesn't like soak through and into the Spectre, does it?
It does not. He is a giant shield for the Spectre.
So it's fully just a giant shield. Yeah, there's no taking it down by just doing damage.
The only way to get through this is removing the door, because that breaks the possession, and then you can take out the Spectre separately.
Really, to me, and this is the, you know, to be very clear, this is not a criticism in any way. You've made one, I think, very interesting and cool monster, and then you've also made an encounter or a scenario using that monster.
Yeah.
Really, the Impaled Rancor and the whole story behind it and then how it functions is very much like, you know, that's not the meat and potatoes of this. It's the Spectre, and then this is maybe like an example of a way that it can do this in a very fun way that is like a full encounter to itself that would be like at the end of a dungeon or something, or at the end of an adventure, which I think is super cool.
I picture the party entering a dungeon that's already been mowed through, right? A separate party has already gone through. You see corpses everywhere. Seemingly everything is dead, but you see, you know, bits of metal sticking out of all the bodies. So the Spectre can just jump from corpse to corpse and animate things as it goes.
That's freaky.
Also, very horror space station. You're absolutely right. This is the perfect space.
Perfect for that kind of thing. It's great.
Cyberpunk horror campaign.
Yeah, you could run it like that. You could run it with it animating these various corpses. You could also have almost like a switcheroo where the party thinks that, oh, this big scary monster defeated all of these things. Oh, but they defeated it. Look, it like all of the damage to these other adventurers that they see is clearly done by a massive monster. So like this thing ran through it, but they defeated it. We're fine. But then weird stuff keeps happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then that thing reanimates and they can't figure out how to get rid of it. Yep. That's neat and cool. I think there are just multiple ways to use this in a really fun way. I can imagine it, being, even without utilizing the Rancor part of the stat block, I think the Spectre itself alone would make for a really interesting encounter, one-shot adventure, whatever it is, to like explore some strange area, mm-hmm. and like different little constructs can keep being animated by this, and maybe you could have a larger construct near the end or something like that. If you're using Warforged, whatever it is, I think there are lots of fun, cool ways to mess around with this and make it really, really fun. And it's the kind of thing where you can have the party think that they beat this thing, and then it kind of sinks back into the larger area, and you're like, where did it go? Where is it?
No.
It's very, very The Thing. It's great sci-fi horror that you've built here, I think.
Thanks, man. Well, if you listening in have any ideas how you would create a Rancor who uses a door as a weapon or a shield or as a means of possession, please reach out to us. We would love to hear your ideas. You can always email us at collegeofcreationpod@gmail.com. Reach out to us on TikTok. I am there at Michael_Barlos. Dan can be found on TikTok at SirDrK. Or you could find us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/collegeofcreationpod. Please reach out to us any of those places. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I suppose my Rancor could feasibly possess someone with its door just by impaling you, and then your dead body is just sort of moved around at its whim.
Yeah, absolutely. I think,
does that count as possession?
Yeah, that... a much more gruesome, visceral version of possession.
Yeah. Oh man.
More
I
puppetry
believe,
than
my
possession.
Friend, it is. Yeah, really more. I think it is my turn to roll this time. Is it not?
Yes.
All right. Rolling for our newest homebrew prompt for next week. Next week, we will be creating number 11.
Number 11 is a spell scroll alternative for single-use features.
Oh.
A spell scroll alternative.
This one is also from So You Want to Be a DM on TikTok. Thank you again, Justin. Coming in hot with a lot of the good submissions here. I like this one a lot. I've always been bothered by the idea that only spellcasters with a spell on their list can use a spell scroll.
Yes, I think a lot of people have kind of adopted the Baldur's Gate method at this point, though, where if you find the spell scroll, you just cast the spell from the scroll and then it burns up.
Yeah,
maybe not. Maybe that's just me in the circle that I have talked to. But yes, I think the antiquated definition is you need it to be on your spell list, and you have to be able to cast the spell with the same means that you would if you knew the spell.
I do think they're just to sort of play devil's advocate and give us a good reason to actually take on this prompt. I think that just allowing anybody and everybody to cast from spell scrolls is fine, but it does a little bit devalue your party casters.
Yes.
If everybody can go into a magic shop and just buy whatever spell scrolls, why do you need a wizard to be buying those and copying them down? What can we put in there that makes it more interesting and also gives it a way that it's not taking away the necessity of having someone who can actually cast real spells in your party?
Right. Yeah, that is a good point. And this is a very cool prompt with that in mind. Is it opens up possibilities for classes like rogues and monks that have like magic adjacent functionality, but aren't necessarily, you know, barring some subclasses, they aren't necessarily casters in the sense that a sorcerer or a wizard would be a caster. Mm-hmm. This is cool.
I'm also very excited for this. This feels like the kind of thing that's more than we're creating an item or even a feat or even like a feature, we're creating almost a new rule of sorts, an entirely new class of thing that can be expanded on, that we can use in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah. The perfect recipe for both of us to create 50 different options for next week.
I love it. It's great. I'm very excited to see what we both come up with. Hopefully we can come up with something that will be fun and cool for ourselves to use in games and our followers. So look forward to that next week. Michael, before we leave, do you have anything to say to the people?
Dan, you know that I always have something that I'd love to share with our listeners before we say goodbye. And today,
I do. Of course I do.
It's a real short one. Hey, guys, it's okay to become attached to your characters. It's okay to care about your player characters. It's okay to invest time and brain power and energy into crafting a character that you really enjoy playing and that you love to be around. That's fine and normal and not weird at all. And I mean that in the most sincere way possible. I still play as my first character sometimes as an NPC in my games, and I love it every single time. It is a fantastic connection that you can make, and I urge you to do it and see if you like it as well.
I am 100% on board with that. I am so attached to like 3 or 4 of my PCs, and I just keep going back to them. They're the best.
Hey, Dan, thanks for a great episode.
Thank you, Michael,
to the listeners for your fantastic submissions and for listening to us each week. We appreciate you to no end.
Absolutely. You can find all the creations that we've made here today, all of our other creations that we've made for now, like almost 3 months running now. We've made a lot of creations already. There's so many of them. You can find all of them on Patreon. That's patreon.com/collegeofcreationpod. We would love to see you over there. And we are so excited to talk to you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey everyone, it's Michael. Thanks for listening to this episode of the College of Creation. If you want to see our creations from this episode and our past episodes, you can find those for free on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/collegeofcreationpod. And if you decide to become a patron, you'll also automatically get access to any revised versions of the things we've created, plus our patron Discord, and bonus chats with Dan and myself. You can send any of your own homebrew prompts or questions to collegeofcreationpod@gmail.com, and our music is by Fuserwolf. You can check out his tunes on Bandcamp and Spotify. As always, thank you so much for listening.